I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians.
That's sad, depressing energy.
I will tell you, speaking of sad, depressing energy, I don't know what it is, Mike. I don't know why. I cannot stop rewatching The Equalizer.
The movie with Denzel Washington? Yes. Or is the old TV show?
Not the TV show. The Denzel Washington movie. The first two of those movies, but more specifically the first one.
Those movies are fucking great.
I don't know what it is. There's a lot of people have those sort of comfort media things. Like, I know people who put on episodes of The Office or something just in the background because it's familiar. It's they like it. I was going to find something charming about something they remember. Or like maybe for us, it might be Next Generation.
Yeah, Star Trek Next Generation is pretty standard for me. Or Back to the Future.
But for whatever reason, for this moment, for this fraught, probably several, like 2 or 3 week period, I keep going back to watching Denzel Washington just fuck assholes up. Like, that all he's doing is
killing a dude with a power drill.
What, you know, white supremacists, human traffickers, drug dealers, corrupt cops, like all of those people, all the people that you're just like, I love it that he's gonna give them one chance and they never take it.
They never do. But I mean, a lot of it is assholes. It's the beautiful fantasy of a world where people like that have real consequences, and they've just fucked with the wrong guy. Was it Antoine Fuqua does those ones? Mm-hmm. Those movies are fucking great, and they're making a third one.
I hope so. God, I hope so.
He's
going to get so old past a certain point, and where it will be less believable.
Yeah,
he's in his 60s now. So
yeah, I think the thing that makes those work in a lot of ways, I think those are the best possible version of what Liam Neeson is doing,
or Charles Bronson for the last 20 years of his career.
Yeah, it's sort of like the golden years of your career where you're killing young punks on the street. Yes. But it's that old guy still got it sort of vibe where you're clearly sort of middle-aged, but instead of getting bad knees and, you know, feeling tired, instead you just get more leathery and meaner as you get older.
Wasn't Denzel Washington's one of his first roles was as Street Punk, and I think number two and
the very first
one. Oh, in the very first one.
There are two famous people that appear as criminals in the first Death Wish.
Is it Goldblum?
Yes it is.
Yes.
Jeff
yes!
Goldblum wearing a Jughead hat. You know, where you take a fedora, you flip it inside out, and you cut a crown into it, is one of the people who attacks his family at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
And what's crazy, because Jeff Goldblum has a sort of, you know, black hair and the facial structure that he does, it looks like Dark Jughead.
Alternate universe Jughead.
It's just crazy.
But I think Denzel Washington's character is less memorable because I think he's just like young kid in the subway, I think.
Yeah, I don't even know. He fights him in an alley or a subway or something. Right. And I don't even remember the part of the movie where Jeff Goldblum is like front and center and coming at him with like a switchblade, I think. And
ironic, though, that Denzel grows up to become, you know, the Keezy.
He's paying it forward.
Yeah, he is.
It's like he was once attacked by a middle-aged vigilante, and now he becomes a middle-aged vigilante. It's the cycle of abuse. But yeah, what I love about the Equalizer movies is it is the Denzel factor.
Right.
You give this script to another older actor. Like if you'd given this to, I don't know,
Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson, for instance.
Sure.
These are direct-to-VHS type style movies from the 80s.
Right, right.
It's pulpy, it's fun, it's kind of trashy. You give it to Liam Neeson, and you have just another Liam Neeson movie. That isn't to say that they're written badly or that they're directed badly, but it's the Denzel factor that elevates it, because I think what he does, and he did this in Man on Fire as well, which kind of turns these into a trilogy of Denzel is my Punisher. What he does is he elevates this by giving a layered, nuanced performance to a script that probably doesn't deserve it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's definitely going to elevate it a letter grade just by his line deliveries, right?
There's sort of a sad vulnerability in him. There's a humanity in him. There's the sense that there's an inner life to a character that it might not be there on the page, that he brings it, and that makes this movie so much better and richer than it would be.
And there are weird little, I don't know if these are part of the script or these were part of the, what they worked up, but there's these weird little character things that they add. Like, he just has to, like, when he sits down, he has to square everything on a table. Like, he has to make sure, like, the cup is here and a book is close to here. So you kind of have this idea of, like, he might be this obsessive compulsive kind of guy, because mm-hmm. He's got everything on lockdown. He times himself. Like, he wants to be able to know how long it's going to take him to, I don't know, clear a room full of, like, Russian mafia guys, Russian mafia assholes. But I love it because it's like, it could just be the Liam Neeson, and you wouldn't give him that character affect, but give Denzel Washington that character affect, and it adds a little bit more mystery to there are gears turning here that you're not seeing. They're not just explaining in a flashback, you know.
And I like Liam Neeson. Yeah. I think he's a great actor, but Denzel is like on a whole nother level. And I think he gives this character a humanity that kind of takes him out of just being a Mac Bolan clone.
Right, right.
Because there's a lot of Mac Bolan clones out there.
Sure.
And there's this other element of him being a typically unassuming guy who just kind of seems like he's somebody's dad who stumbles into a situation where, you know, he's an Uber. No, he's a Lyft driver. You're right. I have the product placement. Right. I have to get that product placement right.
You sure do.
he's a Lyft driver who gets to this house and there's a bunch of like Wall Street bro type investor, I don't know, analyst, whatever bullshit job those guys have, because they're all right. Pieces of shit. Right. And it's clear they're at some sort of coke and sex party that's winding down. And they've got a young girl there who's clearly drugged, and stuff probably happened to her before Denzel was called to basically pick her up and drop her off somewhere. It's clear that she's not in a good way. So he picks her up, takes her to the emergency room, and comes back. And what I love is that he fucking clears house. They're like, "What are you doing here, old man?" And of course, it's a bunch of dudes in like their 20s with their button-up striped shirts.
Yeah, they and are. Little Gordon Gekko wannabes.
These guys that are definitely flashing their daddy's money. And right. It's like, these are just the worst possible kinds of people that you have. These are the sort of people that in real life end up on the Supreme Court after a party like this has definitely happened several times in their past.
Right.
And I try to remember when did Equalizer 2 came out? It was like 2018, 2019?
2017, I think. Or okay. Maybe 2018.
Yeah. So the Brett Kavanaugh hearings were in our recent past.
Sure.
And I have to think that those went into this scene in some way where you're like, we're so used to privileged pieces of shit like this that are usually have a job in finance working for their dad. Who can get out of any kind of actual legal consequences because they have high class lawyers, and there's a lot of judges out there like, oh, but his whole life is ahead
right,
of him.
Right.
What about all the people he didn't rape?
And they add the extra thing for that scene, which is he says, I'm going to need all the cameras or anything you might have used to record her, because there's the extra thing, which is, you know, these motherfuckers are like, well, we're going to run a train on this girl. We're going to rape her or do humiliating things, and we're going to put it on camera, which is a way of dehumanizing it. Like recording their crime.
Yeah.
But they're like confident that like it doesn't matter. It's not
going to feel
it's not going to end up on social media.
They're
right?
Untouchable. Yeah. I mean, that's how they see it. And that's always the turning point in a movie like this, which is they just fucked with the wrong guy. This guy actually gives a shit about human beings, and he doesn't give a shit about them, and he can do something. So they start trying to fuck with him, and then it's that point where he goes beep beep on his watch to start to time himself, and you're like, uh-oh. And if this movie was just Denzel Washington vigilante Lyft driver killing rapists, I would have been happy watching that for 2 hours,
yeah.
Watching this guy fuck with people. What is a power fantasy ultimately, which is to see something in fiction that you wish would happen in real life.
Right.
Like these kinds
right.
of people frequently get away with it, and now they've stepped in it.
Well, I mean, I just love that the idea that the Denzel Washington is, and of course, it's a total stereotype kind of a bad guy, but like he just goes and just like destroys a Russian, like a Russian mafia type oligarch, his entire organization. He just like one guy goes right to the top, cuts off the head, right? And it's like, and you know, it's impossible. It's like a Jason Bourne kind of an impossibility thing where you're just like one person couldn't do this, but it doesn't matter because it's the equalizer.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And Denzel Washington never raises his voice throughout the entire scene.
Right.
But I kind of, I've noticed that there has been a resurgence of these sort of things, especially in a post-John Wick media world.
Right, right.
Like Nobody was another one that
right,
came out.
Right,
if you wanted to see Bob Odenkirk kick the shit out of people. And I love Bob Odenkirk. It finally kind of feels like in a post-Breaking Bad, you know, Better Call Saul world, the world finally appreciates him in the way that we all have since Mr. Show.
Right.
Back in the day, where we knew
this guy can do anything.
This guy's hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, Bob Odenkirk wrote the Living in a Van Down by the River sketch for Saturday Night Live.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that weird is when you know it, it totally feels like a Mr. Show sketch.
It does, yeah.
And it has that flavor to it, the sort of weirdness of parents hiring. And again, it's that weird experience that you remember from school and you might not have thought about, the motivational speaker. The idea that this guy who comes down and you're like, who the fuck is this guy? Except you feel like he's managed to Pied Piper scam his way into a job where he takes to a bunch of like high school students at an auditorium. And the whole joke of him basically talking to these children on a couch as if he's still in an auditorium is wonderful.
Yeah. I was going to say that is one thing that you could put, that you could kind of put the McCall character, the Denzel Washington character from Equalizer, is he could be that sort of didactic scolding kind of guy. But I think the other piece of it that works, because it's not just about him killing a bunch of people that desperately need to be killed, there's the other bit, which is when he's just trying to blend in and have a life, he just helps everyone that's around him. He sees people who are vulnerable, he sees people who are being fucked over, or he just sees like the security guard guy. He's just like, oh, there's this guy who wants to get this position and he needs to lose some weight, and so Denzel Washington is going to become his personal, like, physical trainer and motivational coach.
Yeah, he's kind of like the doctored Richard Kimball, where he's sort of coming into people's lives, helping them. It's a highway to heaven, except he breaks people's fingers. Where he's kind of coming in, he's becoming somebody's best friend, and then when you realize that, wait a minute, I just wanted to thank. Well, he's gone. I mean, there's a lot of that in
right,
there,
right.
But in the meantime, we also get to see him like break a dude's shoulder while quietly explaining something to him. And again, the power fantasy is I think that these movies sort of give away something about the people who make them by showing you the kind of targets in these movies. And I think when you have this sort of like finance bros who take advantage of young women and dehumanize them and abuse them, that is a sort of target. You're like, okay, it tells me something that the person who made this movie, Antoine Fuqua, is like, those pieces of shit always get away with it.
Right, right.
They're not getting away with it in my movie. And I think it says something about you. Like when you watch the old Death Wish movie, you're like, oh,
right,
reactionary
exactly.
suburban white dad.
That's the difference, because the one thing that McCall never does is he never like rolls up on the corner dealer and like breaks his arm or something. Like that's totally outside of his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
If he's in that world at all, it's the fucking the mafioso guys who will kill anyone, will enslave anyone. It's like the mafioso guys who are murderers and like human traffickers or whatever. But it's not the same as, is it Kesey? What's his Kesey? No, not Ken Kesey. What
Paul
Kiersey.
Kiersey.
Yes, he's like, he's so the opposite of Kiersey, because Kiersey is the reaction to like it's poor people that are running all around that are making it worse. Like
it's basically, you know, the fears of somebody who has been hopped up on a bunch of, God, what was the name of that guy? They ran during the like Michael Dukakis campaign. They ran a bunch. They said, oh, he let this guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What is the name of the guy that I'm thinking of? Anyways, everyone can Google it.
Right.
But there was an anti, you know, this guy is soft.
Willie Horton.
It's a sort of Willie Horton paranoia of, oh my God, if you're anything other than Judge Dredd about even the smallest broken window street crime, then civilization is going to fall and we're going to turn into Mad Max. And there's this fear that, oh my God, I see a young black man with saggy pants. Oh my God, what am I going to do? I'm clutching my wallet and I better pull out an oversized handgun. If only if only I was Charles Bronson. And you can see it again in the Death Wish remake with
Bruce.
Yes, Bruce Willis.
I didn't see it, and I think I was just was worried that it was going to be, you know, we enjoy right-wing propaganda when it comes in these particular genres.
Yeah, but we approach it from the perspective that we know that this is a cartoon,
right,
and it is kind of awful.
But this one seemed a little bit too close to, hewing too close to the being, like, aspirational. And I'm like, I don't know if that's what you want a vigilante movie to be, aspirational in that way.
I think the right-wing propaganda has to also be a cartoon if it's to be enjoyable to somebody like me, that it has to be something so cartoonish where it's Stallone with, like, a match in his mouth saying, crime is a disease and I'm the cure. It's got to be something where he is such a fucking maniac.
Or it's Red Dawn, you know, it's teenagers in the woods fighting paratroopering Soviet troops, right?
Yeah, it's just, it's everything that those guys that occupied that bird sanctuary in Oregon, it's everything that they jerk off to. But the minute actual bullets are in the air, those guys, like, I think there was those guys live streamed themselves.
Oh, of course they did.
But I think my favorite moment is there's like a live streamed moment with those guys all exchanging stories about their time in the military. And then people did background checks and it turns out all of them had never been in the military.
Uh-huh.
They're all just bullshitters. But again, Red Dawn is the thing that they have. So I don't know. I think there's a part of me that, I think it's fascinating to talk about things like popular culture that rather than an actual Willie Horton ad that's being put out, to look at something like Red Dawn, because the Willie Horton ad ultimately is largely forgotten by everyone. Politics always seems to exist in a constant present tense,
right?
That there is no past, there is no future. There's only now. And if the propaganda we're spitting now doesn't match what we said last time, then we just disregard it. But Red Dawn, you can still buy on DVD now. And that's the thing. Yes. You can still buy Rambo 3, where the Mujahideen is still treated like they're the new, like, American Minutemen. They're like the new revolutionary heroes. they're just amazing people instead of like the progenitors of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Right, right.
You're thinking, oh, okay. And instead of, you know, these are the best, they're the heroes of Afghanistan, rather than they're a bunch of, like, armed reactionary fundamentalists that we armed and trained. We were happy to accommodate them because it fit in well with our horror at maybe nationalized industries in another country where otherwise American corporations can take them over.
Right.
And no, that never ends badly. That never ends badly when we back right-wing lunatics in a country.
I mean, you could, this is from so much John Le Carre I've got, which is the idea is, it's the idea of the Cold War essentially was, well, we're just fighting, it's just one perpetual war that we end up fighting, even though to us, like, to the sort of public facing, you have, what are the wars? You've got, like, there's the Vietnam War, the Korean War, those are the actual, what, throughout that entire time, if we're arming the Mujahideen to fight against Russia, who ostensibly was our enemy, and I suppose still is our enemy.
It's a different Russia, though.
It's a different Russia.
It's weird. Like,
it's still a war that we're fighting against them, but yeah.
But again, what is it that we're angry about a lot of the time? We're angry that there is stuff and natural resources and cheap labor potentially in a country that we can't exploit. Oh my God, they're giving shit to poor people. Oh my God, they nationalized the mining industry.
So I saw the first half. Me and my oldest, we had to go because he was not going to be able to get through the rest. I saw the first half of the new Black Panther movie.
Mm-hmm.
And on this thing of what you're talking about, of trying to project Anton Fuqua, the things that he bothers him in the world, the assholes who get away with it. I love that there's a part when Princess Shuri, and whoever the general is of the assassin squad,
mm-hmm. Dora Milaje?
Dora Milaje, yes. Are like, they're going somewhere, they got to find one of these characters, and then they're sort of on their own and they're supposed to be sneaking around, and then like the FBI and the police show up, and I love the way the characters are just like, they're like, don't worry about them. They're not a problem. You need to worry about the other, you need to worry about the other things that are coming. But I love that the idea is that you know, what's the name of the guy who directed it? Oh shoot.
Oh, you're Coogler. Talking about Coogler.
Coogler, yeah. Is that Coogler, as for a power fantasy, he wants to create characters who have dark skin, who come from a different part of the world, who scare other people, and if they're surrounded in a warehouse with police and FBI with guns, they're like, don't worry about it. They're not a problem. Because the most people watching this movie, the intended audience of this movie, is that's the most terrifying thing they could ever think of.
Yeah.
Is what would happen if a bunch of like screaming, tactical vest wearing guys with machine guns are surrounded your house and are yelling at you.
Yeah, I think that's where the power fantasy comes from, is you take the things that you're afraid of. I mean, this is where Batman and Superman came from.
Sure.
That you what did Batman do? You were afraid to go down the street without getting mugged. Well, what if there was a guy that beat the shit out of the people you were afraid of?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same thing with Superman. A lot of the early Superman stories, he's not so much a guy punching asteroids or fighting for the, you know, truth, justice, and the American way, whatever that means. Superman was somebody who went after like slumlords or a crooked mine owner who was making people go down into a mine that he knew was unsafe. And he would like intentionally throw the mine owners down there and make it collapse so they were trapped and they knew what it felt like. And before making them beg to come out, or, you know, he'd go after like a wife beater or something. There'd be that element, and you could sort of feel the things that Siegel and Schuster were angry about.
Sure, sure.
And I think a lot of heroic fiction at its core is about, well, what are the things that really piss you off? And can we manufacture a fictional person who just beats the shit out of that thing?
What I find fascinating is, I mean, we can't, it's impossible for us to talk about intended audiences when you're talking about sort of where superheroes are now. And this is not a superhero conversation, and I don't want to have one.
No.
But I'm going to say what is fascinating is the Siegel and Schuster being, they were like in their 30s, right, when they started?
No, they were super young.
Oh, they were in like, their 20s?
No, even younger than that. They were like almost teenagers.
Oh,
they were
wow.
Barely adults.
So that's, it's interesting. I was going to say, if you get a Stan Lee, for example, and you know that you're pitching these stories down to kids, usually kids who are just about able to start reading, right? That's where the sort of stories are pitched at. It's fascinating to think about, instead of making just sort of these cosmic conflicts and these sort of huge stakes. Like, I think every time I read a Ninja Turtle story now to my kids, it's like the story pretty much has the same premise, which is usually the Krang want to destroy New York through some plan, and then they have to foil them. But it's like every single time it's like, it's gonna kill the whole city. Okay, well, we're gonna stop them. That's the kind of thing that you would sell to kids. It takes a grown-up, it takes someone at looking, being able to look at the world outside of sort of the scope and imagination of a six-year-old to be able to be like, yeah, sometimes the evils in the world are, oh, I don't know, mercenaries who kill people for money, you know, like who go into another country and kill people for money. That takes an awareness that is outside of the intended target audience for those comic books.
Yeah.
Which I guess is, in that sense, I guess that's a little didactic, isn't it? It's wanting to teach kids a type of social morality through these morality tales, right?
It's kind of weird when you see the differing kinds of power fantasies clash against each other. Because you can watch something like, say, a Spider-Man movie, and a big part of Spider-Man is sometimes having to save the life of his own enemy. That Spider-Man wants to protect life at all cost. And it's very different from, you know, The Equalizer.
Right.
It's very different from Frank Castle, The Punisher, where, or John Matrix in Commando.
Sure.
John Matrix in Commando gleefully wades through generations of guys who run at him, and he ends their lives. I mean, there are the population of that island before and after he attacks it at the end of that movie, drastically different. It loses like a congressional district. And he doesn't care. He doesn't feel anything. But again, Spider-Man feels so bad that he has to save somebody even from their own hubris. Like, their own doomsday device is going to kill them, and Spider-Man has to go in there and stop that. So you kind of, in a weird sort of way, meet the movie where it's at, that you take on the kind of ethical framework of your hero.
Sure.
A lot of times in those kind of stories. But when those things clash, like in the new Black Adam movie, it can be really confusing. And I was thinking about this.
Lord.
That movie is a mess. And I don't want to get into totally it, but I want to talk about one element of it, which is that if you have a Spider-Man type hero and a Punisher type hero appear in the same story, the most important question is, whose story is it? So if you're reading a Spider-Man comic and the Punisher shows up, you're reading a Daredevil comic and the Punisher shows up, the Punisher is going to be like an antagonist.
Right.
He's the guy who comes in, he's trying to kill the person that Spider-Man's trying to save, that Spider-Man knows that maybe that deep down this person deserves a second chance, or they've been a victim of circumstance, or they're crazy, or there's something in there where, you know,
they've been mutated through a scientific experiment.
That's like half of Spider-Man's villains. But there's this element where even Daredevil, I mean, who beats people up way worse than Spider-Man typically does,
right?
Doesn't kill people or snap necks or anything like that. He still wants to throw them in jail because, I don't know why, he believes in the legal system where he should know better as a lawyer. But, I mean, that's a big part of his character, that justice is blind. There's all metaphor
within metaphor.
Right. But he wants to save them. So you have essentially this ethical, you know, moral argument that's happening at the core of this story between Daredevil and Spider-Man and somebody like the Punisher. And the Punisher is like, what are you doing? That guy's just going to break out of jail. Bam, bam, bam. He's gone. Problem solved. And the Punisher necessarily becomes an antagonist. You finally like, God damn it, Punisher, why can't you see the decency and the potential for, you know, redemption in people? But here's the thing. When you're in a Punisher story, I paid the cover price of that comic book because I want to see the Punisher be Punisher. If Spider-Man or Daredevil shows up in that book, and this is the problem with Black Adam, is that this is a Black Adam story, and I want to see Dwayne Johnson. I want to see him snap some necks. I want to see him zap some dudes into ash. I want to see him throw dudes into the ocean. I want to see him blow some shit up. I mean, that's what the movie sells itself as. That this is, what if the Punisher had Superman powers?
Right.
And then the Justice Society shows up. And the problem when you have a Punisher story where Daredevil or Spider-Man shows up is now suddenly Spider-Man or Daredevil are like wet blankets that won't let you get what you paid the admission price to see. That I'm here to get that cathartic charge. And this asshole, this fucking naive piece of shit won't let me do it. He is actively setting himself up as the antagonist. And there's this confused morality about what does the writer want me to feel in this moment? And that was the big confusion at the heart of Black Adam, which is, I think the movie wants me to like, and I don't know how much, but certainly to some degree, side with the Justice Society. Hawkman is constantly wagging his finger and telling Black Adam to not do Black Adam stuff. And that's something that's very confusing. The other problem with that movie, too, is that I thought we had pretty canonically set up that Amanda Waller is like the ultimate evil in the DC universe.
Right.
That she, like, everything bad you can say about,
you
like,
had such a crazy clash of tones, which is, you set up Kandak, is that the name of the fictional
Middle Eastern country?
Middle Eastern country that sounds or looks like something you'd imagine in Western media. But when Black Adam comes, they're like, everyone on the street is like, hooray.
Yeah.
they're like, hooray. Jesus fucking Christ, finally.
They've been living under the occupation for decades of it's ostensibly Western Blackwater style military organization.
Right.
Like a military, like private military. It's like if Blackwater had like super high tech sci-fi tech and had been occupying them for decades. And Black Adam shows up and starts killing those dudes who have been oppressing them and stomping on their neck for decades, stealing their natural resources. And then Hawkman shows up now to say, whoa, this, you know, violence is bad, kids. And you're like, where the fuck have you been? You only care when it's somebody shows up and starts doing violence and it's a threat to you, but the constant decades of militarized oppression was something you were just fine with before
now? They can't, we talked about this with the Superman thing before, is you can't really do too much of real world problems with those characters, right? You can't. Because automatically it means that Superman's a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Right.
How much bad shit... I mean, this is the problem that I get into, too. Is like, I read an old X-Men comic a while back. And I love the X-Men, especially the sort of Chris Claremont 1970s to 1980s era. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's this flashback story about how Xavier and Magneto met. And Xavier can still walk. And they get involved in this story that involves like a Hydra cell. These are like Nazis that are kidnapping people and experimenting on them. And Xavier and Magneto look into it. And when they get down there, you know, they're just like, they're both horrified, but Magneto acts a lot more decisively and just makes this entire mountain collapse on them and kills a bunch of Nazis. And Xavier, guess what he starts
of
doing?
Of course.
Just he launches, oh my God, you're just like, one, don't fucking wag your finger at a Holocaust survivor about what he does to Nazis, first of all. And two, you're just, unless Magneto actively commits genocide on that scale, you're not as bad as the Nazis. I wish people would stop. Liberals need to stop saying that shit. As soon as you put your notes, you're just as bad. It's like, no, that Nazi.
32 minutes, Mike.
Okay.
We made it 32 minutes before we started. Carry on.
But I mean, there's this point where he just starts losing it and getting self-righteous and sanctimonious with Magneto. And the thought that popped into my head, and I'm quoting it directly here. Oh, grow up, Charles. It was like, Jesus Christ. It's fucking Nazis.
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobia Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
That you called to take home your girlfriend?
Not a girlfriend, man. Just an intern.
Oh, I'm sorry. The credit card was invalid.
Shithead! Let you hang with us because your daddy's a client. You fuck up the first thing.
Come in. There you go.
Wow. I heard about these. I've never seen one before.
Yeah, well, now you have.
Yeah.
Look, pay yourself whatever and give yourself a nice tip.
Thank you. Thank you. You're not going to ask me if she got home okay?
She get home okay?
No. Took her to Mass General. They're pumping her stomach as we speak. What's her name? You don't know, do you? Okay. This is the point where usually I'd... give you a chance to do the right thing, but not tonight. Tonight I'm gonna need your cameras, cell phones, anything you might have used to record what you did to her.
Pops. Get up. Get up! Don't start crying now. Give me your phone. Right or left?
I don't know what you mean.
Handed. Are you right or left-handed?
Right.
Call 911. You tell them the truth about what happened in here tonight. Your daddy's money's not gonna save you this time, you understand?
Yes, sir.
You know her name?
No.
Her name is Amy. Give me your left hand. Give me your left hand. I expect a 5-star rating, you understand?
Yes, sir.
Not for me, though. For who?
For Amy.
That's right. For who?
For Amy.
For who?
For Amy. Ah!
Make sure I get a 5-star rating, Junior.